And now let's come to understand how the CAN bus protocol manages possible errors present into the communication. Typically, errors are due to the presence of noise or to internal mechanisms to the nodes that cause a difference between the moment into which the nodes are sampling, the levels that the nodes are detecting, and the amplitude of the signal that a node receives. In slide 1 and 20, these three different possible situations are shown from top to bottom. In the first case, we have a phase shift in sampling time that is clearly represented in the picture, since we have a node that samples the value of the signal present into the bus into a certain moment shown by the black arrow in the left position. And we have another node that samples the same signal in another moment into which the signal is not at the same value as before. The problem is not in the signal, but the problem is in the phase shift between the two sample moments relative to the two nodes that probably in turn will be caused by a difference in the two clocks that synchronize the time into the two nodes. Another problem that we can encounter is the presence of different discrimination thresholds. In other words, the amplitude of the signal can be recognized as for example, a logic 1 by a node and a logic 0 by another node, but the amplitude is always the same, due to the fact that the threshold in the two nodes have been set in the proper way. But due to the life of the components in the two nodes may be changed, and this brings the two nodes to give different answers when they are when they have to recognize the same signal. And finally, the attenuation of a signal onto the line will bring to acknowledgement errors, because the same amplitude of a signal that has been sent correspondingly to a, for example, sequence of 1 followed by 2 logic zeros could be understood as a sequence of logic zeros due to the fact that the amplitude of the signal has been reduced by the attenuation of the line and the absence of suitable repeaters that reinforce the amplitude of the signal itself. What is the policy for the management of the error that is implemented into the data leak layer of a CAN bus? First of all, the situation is the node controller detects an error and transmits an error frame. We will see how an error frame has been conceived. But this is enough for all the other nodes that are present in that moment into the network to ignore the message that is considered not valid. So this policy destroys the present communication onto the bus. The controller is upgraded and sometimes is reset, and the message is retransmitted. The protocol foresees a set of possible situations that determine errors. The first is related to the bit monitoring, since the bits must be always equal to what is transmitted. In other words, every transmitting node always monitor the status of the network so as to understand if what it transmitted remains into the network itself. Clearly, this is absolutely reasonable, but we know that there is a situation into which this doesn't happen, that is the arbitration moment. In that case, the difference between what I am writing onto the network and what remains into the network itself is interpreted by the node as the exit of the arbitration. If it remains, I am the winner. If it changes, I have lost the arbitration. Okay, that is the only moment into which this can happen, but instead, outside the arbitration phase, that is outside those 11 bits corresponding to the identifier into a data frame or a remote frame, an event that causes the modification of what has been written into the network is interpreted as an error situation. So, first condition. Second condition, the violation of the bit stuffing rule. We have said that just to improve the synchronization between the nodes, after 5 equal bits, one, let's say, fake different bit is inserted just to allow the synchronization hardware to keep every time the same rate as the transmitting node one. If for every reason 6 consecutive equal bits are sent onto the bus, this is a stuff error and a correspondent management must be implemented. We remember that there is an exception to such a kind of situation, and this exception is represented by the overload frame, but there is a specific condition for this, that is, send these bits during the first 3 bits of an interframe space, otherwise, error. Frame check, let's say this is a very coarse kind of situation that corresponds to a packet of bits organized into a structure, into a frame that is not one of those we have previously described and that are recognized by the standard. CRC, cyclic redundancy check. This means that the code that has been received doesn't correspond to the received sequence that, of course, undergoes to a calculation of the CRC factor. In this case, an error is raised up because clearly this means that during the transmission something went wrong. And finally, the acknowledgement situation, that is, we remember that if a frame sent has been correctly received, the ACK field is overwritten with a dominant beat typically is recessive. The modification of this beat with a dominant value is interpreted as one node correctly received this information. If the transmitter that is monitoring such a kind of bit until the transmission ends doesn't detect this changing, this change, it interprets it as the transmission has not been correctly completed. Therefore, we have to consider the possibility of an acknowledgement error. Before looking at the structure of an error frame, it is important also to understand how the standard implements the confinement of those nodes that are particularly fault generating. In other words, are characterized by a very high error rate. First of all, let's understand how to evaluate this error rate. To this purpose, every node is characterized by two counters that are incremented when an error in the reception or an error in the transmission occurs. In particular, in case of a faults due to the transmission, these counters are incremented by 8, while in case of receiving errors they are incremented by 1. That is, a transmission error is considered worse, more dangerous, more critical than error during the reception phase. Instead, if a transmission or a reception were completed correctly, these two parameters, these two values, are diminished by 1. On the basis of these values, the counters, let's say, provide a snapshot of the status of each node. A node is called, is considered error active if both the counters are less than 128. In this case, the error rate is not considered a very frequent event, so it doesn't disrupt the normal traffic onto the bus, and the node is allowed to play an active role so as to send error frames if necessary. In other words, the error signaling by such a kind of nodes is not considered a critical issue that can compromise the transmission onto the bus. Error passive, a node that features at least one counter with a value greater than 128. So the node causes the faults quite frequently, not in a considered critical way, but let's say we raise up the attention on this node. So it is not completely excluded by the communication, but the possibility for it to interrupting the general communication onto the network through error frame generation is reduced, is let's say confined. Passive means that only passive error frames will be transmitted. We will see what is a passive error frame, but basically this means that no automatic retransmission of the message can be asked by such a kind of node. And moreover, we have already seen this, For such a kind of notes, the intermission frame is longer than for other active notes. In other words, they must wait more before starting a communication that is request a frame or provide a frame requested by another node. A third group of nodes is the so-called bus off, into which one of the two counters is equal to 256. This means that the node is seriously affected by errors, and the access to the bus is temporarily forbidden. Temporarily means that the node is suspended, is excluded for a certain interval from the communication, but periodically we try to re-admit it into the community. Suitable bit sequences have been conceived in the standard so as it is possible to re-enable a bus off node and to reset it as eventually error active, that is with the two counters set to zero. For example, a sequence with 128 frames with 11 consecutive recessive bits is one of these typical sequences. But what it is important is to remember that this is possible for a certain number of times, otherwise if in any case the counters tend to increase to such a kind of values, the node probably will be affected by a very serious problem, and in that case it must be excluded from the communication definitively. This is a very efficient management policy of the errors, and a not detected fault can be considered a very rare event during the bus activity. So, after all these premises, let's take a look to the structure of an error frame, that is, what bits and what fields characterize it. Basically, we have two fields, a flag and a delimiter. The flag is made by 6 bits, dominant or recessive, depending on the specific node that can send them. If the node is an active error, this means that it can write into the network 6 dominant bits. This means that the traffic will be interrupted because the 6 dominant bits violate the staffing rule. And remember, we are not generally speaking in the 3 bits of the intermission frame. So this is a situation of error, and this error will be detected by the other nodes present in that moment into the network. They will send in turn their error flags. So again, like in the case of the overload frame, we see that an error frame has error flag filled with 6 bits, and another, let's say, interval into which other 6 bits corresponding to error flags are sent by all the other nodes in the community that acknowledge the situation raised up by one node. So we have a phase of superposition of error flags that clearly can be wide 6 plus 6 bits. If the node on the other end is qualified as passive, that is not excluded by the community, allowed to raise up error situation signaling, but not in not so as to interrupt the message exchanging. That error will write into the network 6 bits as before, but recessive. So they can be overwritten by other active error flags if other nodes detect critical situations, but they can't overwrite the acknowledgement or the end of frame fields of a data frame, and this means that they can't destroy the traffic. More or less, the situation is that the node is critical in terms of errors detection, but its rate is not so high to exclude it from the communication. Otherwise, on the other hand, we have to be careful with such a kind of node. So it's, let's say, signaling of critical situations is frozen, is not considered by all the other nodes in the network. And this is due to the fact that the node tries to put an error frame, that is, try to notify the other nodes into the network that a critical situation for it is present, but the other nodes don't consider this notification because the bits of which this notification is made are recessive, so can be overwritten by every other dominant possible bits that can be sent onto the network for every other reason. We have said that we have another field into the frame called the limiter, that is 8 recessive bits just to identify the end of the frame and to, let's say, allow the restarting of the transmission by that node if error passive, or by other nodes if that node is excluded from the community. Slide 124 shows once more the arbitration mechanism that is implemented at the level of the data link layer, that foresees that when a node transmits, write first the start of a frame and then its own identifier. If many nodes try to contemporaneous transmit, the winner among them will be the minor value owner. This is due to the fact that the convention, the agreement that has been chosen, is that a zero written into the bus line is a dominant value with respect to a one. We have already explained that this is simply obtained by implementing a wired NOR sharing of a specific CAN bus line through the presence of several MOS circuits that share the same drain point connected to the bus line, and whose gates are managed by each node that tries to write its own bit onto the gate of the specific moss belonging to it, and the sharing, the we could say the electronic sharing of all these bits will be reflected into the value of the output canvas line by the dominant logic of the connection that has been chosen. In the slide, this is shown in the pictures. The first is the wired NOR circuit that has been selected for such a kind of convention. The second expresses the zero logic dominant philosophy implemented. So we see that the three MOS circuits S1, S2, S3 will write at the beginning 000, then 111, then we have a 1 and a 2 zeros, so S1 will be excluded from the communication. Then only S2 and S3 will continue, and they will continue up to when S2 will write a logic 0 and S3 will write a logic 1, so the arbitration will be won by S2, that will continue into the transmission. The third picture shows the arbitration as it has been conceived among three nodes A, B and C, whose identifiers are 1436, 1335, 1337, and clearly the node that will survive is the second one that features the lower identifier. This is clearly a preemptive priority mechanism that is based on the principle that during the arbitration the node monitors continuously the bus and compares the red level with the transmitted one, with its own transmitted one, and if the two bits don't correspond, in particular if the node sent a recessive bit and it detects a change in the status of the line, it stops its own transmission. In slide 125, another slide related to the arbitration is shown. In this slide, we see that if a CAN node, in a CAN node, the logic level 1 is associated to the recessive logic level, and the logic 0 level is associated with the so-called dominant level. This happens since the line must be set recessive by the transmitter when not driven, so as to minimize the power consumption. If the level is pulled up high, in fact we have no current flow in the electronic circuit. During the arbitration, each node monitors the bus, compares the red level with that transmitted. If the two bits are not coincident, and in particular if the node sent a recessive bit, it breaks the transmission concepts that have been already explained. And finally, just a look to other two layers of the data link, the so-called object layer and transfer layer. These are layers that work at a higher logic concept in the CAN philosophy, since the first one is charged with the task of filtering the messages, that is, the packet received belong or not to the specific node to which the data layer is assigned, is responsible for the interpretation of the received messages, and clearly of the interfacing with the higher user application level. The transfer level instead is at a lower level, that is more close, more related with the physical layer. In fact, it is responsible for the error detection and management, for the faults confinement, for the management of the arbitration, the handshake and the synchronization, and message packing and packet distribution. So, from these very general words, we understand that the management of the operations at this level is more related with physical electronic circuits. Okay, and this ends the part devoted to the CAN bus, and ends also the more general part of the course devoted to the digital communication techniques and protocols. The last part into which we are entering is dedicated to the explanation of the general concepts that characterize embedded systems, and in particular to the architecture of a very popular and diffuse microprocessor family, the ARM family, of which we will see in particular the software point of view, the assembly software point of view, since it is very tightly related to the hardware architecture details that, on the other hand, are out of the scope of this course, because you have already seen similar concepts in the past in two courses, in the bachelor degree and in the first semester of the master degree. So it is not particularly significant to repeat now those issues. Instead, it could be interesting to understand how new characteristics and new tricks or implementation details characterize such kind of microprocessor whose principal aspects and aims is to assure good performance, good elaboration rate, but paying attention also to the power consumption, and even to the size, their own size, related to the space allowed by the processor into which they are indeed embedded. Before focusing our attention on the family ARM of embedded microprocessor, I would like to spend a few minutes about a general introduction of embedded systems. In particular, the aim is to arrive to a specific and enough general definition of an embedded system to describe the challenges that must be faced when designing embedded computing, embedded calculators, and what kind of design methodologies can be devised, considering that typically embedded systems are characterized by constraints in terms of low cost, low power consumption, that often bring the designer towards custom computing. An embedded system can be defined as any system, any device that includes a programmable computer, but it is not itself a general purpose computer.
An embedded system is a system that implements and elaborates suitable applications that are characterized by a strong interaction level with the external world. That means presence of sensors and actuators. And a system, a device, into which commands or operation could be executed and guided not only by a human operator, but also from sensors, or more generally speaking, on an event-driven basis. Often, these characteristics bring the designers to develop an optimized project, to conceive an optimized design that, however, is more special than general purpose conceived. Slide 3 shows the general, more very general idea of an embedded computer, just to show a CPU equipped with suitable peripherals and its own memory that interacts with one or more analog external sources. Several examples can be shown in the market. So, personal digital assistant, printers, cellular phones, smartphones, many devices in automotive applications, the present digital televisions, household appliances, and of course many equipment in the personal computer are all examples of embedded systems. Embedded systems, therefore, often feature at their internal core the presence of a microcontroller, that is a CPU, together with I/O peripherals and onboard memory. And often these microcontrollers are digital signal processors that are microprocessors optimized for digital signal processing, that is particularly equipped with architectural concepts that are oriented towards, for example, a fast acquisition of values from the external world, and filtering, so units but also instructions that, for example, perform a multiply and accumulate operation in very few clock cycles. Multiply and accumulate is a typical operation that is requested when you implement a certain kind of filter on a stream of data acquired. Typical embedded word sizes range from 8-bit up to 32, but even 64. And in this slide, many applications, many intuitive examples are presented that show situation into which an embedded microprocessor into a process controls the behavior of a device. For example, in the front panel of a microwave oven. For example, in a photographic machine, the slide cites the Canon model with three microprocessors, but maybe this device is now obsolete. But we know that many professional machines are equipped with very sophisticated computational units. And of course, the world of the TVs, particular digital televisions, is characterized by the presence of programmable units and even hardwired logic devoted to audio processing and decoding. a particular industrial world that is very sensible and very populated, we could say, by embedded systems is the automotive one. Today, many high-end automotive devices or cars have hundreds of microprocessors. For example, in many models, a 4-bit microcontroller is enough to control the seat belt, or not a 4-bit, but maybe a 32-bit microcontroller can control and run dashboard devices, and more and more and more. Everyone knows a specific part of a car that is controlled through a microprocessor. We could ask, however, if embedded systems relatively to their applications are characterized by specific constraints, and the answer is clearly yes. For example, we can say that one of the main requirement that comes immediately in mind is the real-time operation, and we will see the significance of this issue. But also low manufacturing cost together with low power consumption. Consider that often embedded systems are not connected to wall power, are not connected to a PC, but often are controlled by a computational unit remotely. A typical example that comes in mind is a smartphone, or conversely, a satellite control system. In both these examples, the capability of the computational unit to limit as much as possible the power consumption is clearly mandatory, since the system is powered by batteries that are very sophisticated, but clearly with a charge that is limited. And we have also to consider that the more we continue to charge the batteries, the more we will reduce the life of the batteries themselves. Moreover, such a kind of devices are often characterized by the implementation of complex algorithms related both to signal processing, but even to machine learning and deep learning applications that now are more and more popular and more required directly into the device that controls a particular application process. Finally, an embedded system typically is designed with very tight deadlines by small teams of engineers. We talked about real-time operation. Let's remember a couple of issues related to such a requirement. Real-time doesn't mean fast. Rather, it means that operations must be finished within a certain deadline. That is, we have to respect specific milestones in time. If these milestones, if not respected, can cause dramatic failures, the real-time requirement is considered or called hard real-time. Otherwise, if we only have a degraded performance, but not a crash, the real-time requirement is considered soft. Many systems are also multi-rate, that is, they are required and they are able to handle operations at widely varying rates. This is typical in multimedia applications. We have also non-functional requirements, that is, mass market items that require low manufacturing costs. This is not functional, but this is related to the applications on which embedded systems will run, and this turns out in limited memories, limited power, and limited I/O capability. We are always now used to work with systems with working frequencies at gigahertz level and memories in the order of a gigabyte. But very often embedded systems are characterized by working frequencies in the range of 20 megahertz up to 100 megahertz, and with memory that are very, very low, very, very small, like even few megabytes. And clearly this changes completely the software design and also the approach to the implementation of algorithms that, however, or unfortunately, must be implemented due to the requirements of the applications that typically run on these systems. On the other hand, we have already mentioned the need to keep limited the power consumption, as shown in the lower part of slide 11. That is a critical issue in battery-powered systems, but is also a problem in wall-powered devices because increases the general system costs. Concerning the teams that are involved in the design of such systems, we have to observe that often small time of designers, of engineers, are charged with duties of hardware software design and implementation. Often they must meet tight deadlines, like for example 6 months from the design to the market, and in particular having in mind specific deadlines that must be considered due to particular periods of the year. These teams often must conduct hardware-software debug independently, and this is an issue because when you will have some experience, you will understand immediately that it is very hard to debug the software without having attached the device that must be controlled by such a kind of software. And typical these applications are use and get away. This means that every 6-9 months the team must start again for a new design that clearly starts from the previous version of the object of the device, but is clearly required to introduce at least some elements of novelty. Otherwise, the market attractivity could be seriously compromised. There is an alternative to the usage of microprocessor. Typically is represented by custom logic or field programmable gate arrays, but the classic issue that encourage people to use microprocessors instead to design in custom logic is the time to market. In other words, custom logic designers need a lot of time to achieve reliable and affordable circuits that in any case will be very faster with respect microprocessors or microsystems, but the capability of producing a solution using microprocessors is even faster and better. So the choice between these two alternatives is clearly an option that designers have. Moreover, modern microprocessors are often very efficient. They can use the same logic to perform many different functions, and they can also be conceived in terms of families of products, that is, an architecture base that can be extended or simplified depending on the particular applications to which it will be oriented, with different prices and different functionalities that in any case represent a set of options to the engineer that will use those solutions. Microprocessor, on one side, use much more logic that than does a custom logic to implement the same function, but often they are at least as fast or not so slower than FPGAs, for example, due to the internal characteristics on which they are based. For example, the presence of very heavy and efficient pipeline, elements of parallelism, and a decoding phase that is implemented in a very efficient way. Large design teams, so many persons devoted to the development of that microprocessor or that family of microprocessors, and aggressive VLSI technology that is implemented into the design of the microprocessor that will turn out also in reduced prices, high volumes, while instead custom logic is often very specific and characterized by small volumes of production and therefore higher prices. Even the power consumption is a parameter, an element for the evaluation of the choice between microprocessor and custom logic. In terms of power consumption, typically custom logic is a clear winner for low power devices. However, modern microprocessor often offer features to control the power consumption and even design techniques of the software to keep the consumption limited. And finally, what are the challenges that must be faced when designing embedded systems? First of all, we need to establish how much hardware we need, how big the CPU, how large the memory, and how many peripheral devices we have to introduce in our system. How do we meet our deadlines? Is it better to develop faster hardware, maybe with a reduced life, or a cleverer software that can be upgraded, improved, extended? What about upgradability? Do we better prefer performance or evolution? Because typically the two things don't go together. If you have a very high performance system, probably its life will be not very long. The first supercomputers, the example of the Cray incorporation, is very educative from this point of view. The first supercomputers were very amazing in terms of computational capability, but often their life was very short, because in 6 months, 1 year, even at maximum 2 years, a new device entered into the market, making the previous one rapidly to become obsolete. And how to minimize the power consumption? Turning off unnecessary logic, reduce the usage of the memory, let's say reduce the velocity, the working frequency. All these issues must be considered in the hardware design of the embedded system. But we have also challenges in terms of the final workout. First of all, does it really work? Okay, we have to check if the starting point, the specifications were correct. And if the implementation follows in the correct way, those constraints, those specifications. And if both the conditions are respected, are, let's say, correctly implemented, now what about the tests? How to test the real-time characteristic, that is, how to simulate the final application that needs some constraints to be respected in terms of real time, and how to test the performance of the system on real data before embedding the solution, the design, into the real application. So, for example, using software packets like MATLAB that simulate, reproduce possible external world environments. How to work on the system? That is, how to monitor the performance, the execution of the operation that are required, how to check parts of the system. In other words, how to perform a suitable observability and controllability, in particular in those situations into which we don't have peripherals to interact with the application that embeds the solution, the design that we have carried out, for example, because no keyboards or displays or screens are available. And a restricted development platform is provided. Clearly, this requires that the final step of all the design is the test of the computer in the real machine into which it will be embedded. Design methodologies require a procedure for designing the system, because to establish and to specify the steps on which the design methodology is based helps to be sure that we didn't miss anything, any aspect of the specifications. Moreover, makes the communication inside the team easier, and makes easier also the exchange and the verification of the ideas. The modern technologies makes compilers, tools, software engineering packets, CAD tools, many, let's say, instruments to simplify the development, and in particular to transform the step of the development. In particular, we are talking about software steps, automatic, while keeping the track of the several steps into which this development has been organized. And finally, all these methodologies, correct specifications and general issues should bring the designer to the achievement of the following goals. First of all, performance in terms of a good speed in the execution of the tasks, in the acquisition of the external world parameters, in the respect of the specified deadlines by the constraints of the application we have we are facing with. Functionality and user interface is an issue because the interaction with the system should be as simple and as practice as possible. Power consumption reduced as much as possible, as already said, together with the physical size, that is another issue not mentioned till now, because many applications that are called embedded are applications into which the room for the microprocessor, for the intelligent unit, is not so big. So even a consideration that takes into account that the microprocessor device could be small, and this means low frequency, low power consumption again, must be put in the list of the goals that we have to achieve. Manufacturing costs, of course, and related to the design time, the deadlines that must be respected, the power that this device consumes, but also the power that is necessary to carry out it. Clearly, and that was the message of the previous slide, suitable design methodologies help to manage the design process. Okay, I think that with these groups of slides and with this set of considerations, we have given a general overview of the problems and the steps that are necessary to be considered and followed in designing embedded systems. From now on, we will focus our attention on a very typical family of processor that is popular, is diffused, and features a set of characteristics that are specifically conceived for some of the issues that we have previously mentioned, like low power consumption, like functionalities oriented to signal processing, and more and more and more. This family is the family of the ARM processor, and this will be the content of the next lesson.